Jesuit communities and institutions around the world this weekend will be remembering and honouring the legacy of six Jesuit priests in El Salvador who were assassinated along with their housekeeper and her teenage daughter early on November the 16th, 1989. The eight victims were shot in the head by Salvadoran soldiers in the grounds of the University of Central America in the capital city where they lived and worked. Their massacre at the height of El Salvador's civil war, which claimed over 75,000 lives, sparked an international outcry, especially since Salvadoran army officers were trained and supported by the US military and government. Three army officers and six Salvadoran soldiers were eventually tried on charges of murder and terrorism in 1991. The soldiers who confessed to the killings were acquitted. The commanding officer and his deputy were sentenced to the maximum 30-year sentence for murder. Both were freed under an amnesty 2 years later.
Air Korean and companions died for a negotiated settlement. And as it turns out, in the 2 years that I was working there, during those 2 years, there was a negotiated settlement.
Canadian Jesuit Father Michael Cherney knew well all the men whose bodies were found face down on the grass behind the Jesuits' university residence. And in the wake of the shock and grief that followed their deaths, he chose to go to San Salvador just a few days later to take up where Father Eyakuria and his companions had left off. As El Salvador's president publicly acknowledged the government's role in the murders by posthumously awarding the country's highest honour to the six slain priests, Father Michael shared with me his memories of that November night 2 decades ago.
It was the middle of November when the rebels had entered the capital city and taken a third or maybe even a half of it. And Father Eyakuria was in Europe. And as the emergency worsened, he decided to come back. And he landed on the Monday. And at the same time, the elite battalion that was undergoing American training stopped the training and also went to San Salvador. And that night, they visited, in quotes, they visited the house to sort of see how everything was, claiming it was a security check. But in fact, it was a reconnoiter. And they came back then early on the Thursday morning with the order from the High Command to eliminate Eyakuria and to make sure that they left no witnesses.
Which is why they murdered the housekeeper and her daughter along with the six Jesuits.
That's right. But really we could say they murdered the five Jesuits, the housekeeper and her daughter, in order not to have witnesses to the murder of Eyakuria.
Why did they want to get him so badly?
You see, with the rebels in the city, the army was terrified that the president, who was a right-wing president, nevertheless might name Eyakuria as mediator to get the country out of that crisis. And they were afraid that if Eyakuria was mediator, that they would lose their privileged, let's say, yes, their privileged position as the real drivers of the war. And the great paradox is that by killing Eyakuria, eliminating the danger, in fact, they lost their preeminent position because finally the Americans had to withdraw that unconditional support which they had been giving to the armed forces until then.
You obviously followed quite closely what was going on. How well did you know Father Eyakuria?
Well, I knew all six of them. I never actually lived and worked with him. He's not the one I knew the best, but still, I knew them all well, and they were certainly my brothers. I had visited them every year for the previous years, at least once. So it was family, too.
So it was devastating.
It certainly was.
Yeah. What do you remember? How did you react? Because you decided in the wake of that to go down and take his place, didn't you?
Well, I was at the time, I was in our capital city in Ottawa getting ready for discussions with the government about some elections that were supposed to be coming up. And I do remember that when I heard the news, I already had some kind of premonition that not only something very significant had happened, but that my own life was changing too. And so I accompanied my provincial and a Canadian bishop to the funeral. So they were killed on Thursday. The funeral was the following Sunday. And a day or two later, the Jesuits there asked if I would come back as part of the new team.
What did it feel like in that moment? I mean, you must have realized that your own life was in danger too.
Well, I suppose one is aware of that, but that's... in the background, because the other realities, the other needs, or the other, even you might say, opportunities and obligations are so vivid in your mind that I would say security, your own security, is not really a lively theme in your mind. It's in the background. And in fact, I have to say that in the 2 years I was there, that I rarely felt insecure.
What was it like in those 2 years trying to take over after a massacre like that?
Well, in one sense, it was very difficult and somewhat extraordinary. I remember the first day that I sat at the desk of my predecessor as director of the Human Rights Institute, which is the job that eventually, or that I soon got, Father Segundo Montes. And I sat at his desk and I opened the drawer and I realized that he was the last one to have shut the drawer and that he wasn't there for me to ask him about what's what, but that he had left me everything just as he had left it. And that without any words, without any contact or planning, that I had to carry on. So there was a kind of a sense of, if you want, destiny, a sense of mission. On the other hand, I feel that we were swept up in the drama of the moment and finally in the drama of the Cold War. You remember, perhaps, that Ea and his companions were killed practically at the same moment as the Berlin Wall started coming down. So there was a way in which they also died as the world changed. And we didn't realize it vividly then. But in fact, we were picking up in a very different world than the one in which they had been killed only a few weeks earlier. It's taken us decades to realize that. But it was
the beginning of a new era.
It was very much the beginning of a new era, although we lived it much more as the end of an old one.
How important was the work that they were doing there at the Jesuit University, and in particular the work of that Human Rights Center you mentioned?
Well, the whole university's mission was really to provide a space for dialogue and a space for constructive thinking. Ea Korea was sure that the university had a role not only in discovering or creating the peace, but also in building and rebuilding the country, that they were part of what had to happen if there was going to be a human El Salvador. And within that, then, the Human Rights Institute was perhaps the most neuralgic point of monitoring the war and monitoring the relationships between the rebels and the government, and probably the most important contribution that we were able to make then to the international political reaction, and finally and especially to the negotiation, because ironically, Ea Korea and companions died for a negotiated settlement. And as it turns out, in the 2 years that I was working there, during those 2 years, there was a negotiated settlement. So by the end of 91, Ea Korea had achieved what he had set out to accomplish. Unfortunately, it cost his life. But he did, you might say, he did reach, or his university or his country reached what he had set out for.
So you would say that is the legacy today, perhaps, to the people, particularly to the church there in El Salvador?
That is hard to say, because a university, a Catholic university, indeed the church, is not the primary political and social and economic actor. We accompany our people and we try to help, but we are not the first and final decision makers. And so the way in which El Salvador has developed over the past 20 years makes it hard to say what is the meaning of the legacy today. Certainly it's a beacon of hope in the midst of violence and poverty. That doesn't sound very different from what it was 20 years ago. But that's not in the bipolar world where the two great powers were ready to support factions. This is in this monopolar world of massive competition, I would say cutthroat competition, consumerism, and terrible, terrible marginalization. If you're not participating actively in the world economy, you are as good as nothing. And I don't think El Salvador is much in the world economy.
So what, if you had to describe the role of the university today, then what exactly would it be?
I suppose, because I don't have direct contact with it, but I suppose it's the more patient, less dramatic, less public contribution to the forming of future leaders, future participants in the economy and the politics and in the society, who hopefully, like leaven, as Jesus would put it, leaven in the great mass, will make a difference. But it's invisible to the eye. And then, so it's an act of faith, I think, in a society which is unable to control really its own destiny. It's following the rules that are imposed by the world system to an even greater extent than it did 20 years ago. There, in the violence and in the poverty, to try to form people with principles, values, a vision, and that generosity, which means that you live for your brothers and sisters and not just for yourself. That's revolutionary. And I hope that that's what they're doing. I trust they are. Yeah, Korea would have put it in a more demanding and more visionary way, but he didn't know the world we're in now.
Their vision was one of liberation for the poor of El Salvador, wasn't it? And Archbishop Romero, of course, and other leaders were also part of this. Other Catholic leaders in Latin America were also part of this. That what we call liberation theology is still something of a rather unresolved question for the Church, isn't it?
I would put it differently. It's an unresolved question in relation to society. One of the advantages of the liberation approach is that you can then imagine, state, and even symbolize liberation from and liberation for. And that was apparently, that seemed to be fairly clear 30 and even 20 years ago. What is the from today? Because the system is different in a country like El Salvador. I would be very surprised if you talk any more about the 14 families or any other sort of small group of very powerful forces, decision makers. And so you have a much more vaguer or much more pervasive, call it system if you like, which we call the globalized market or the globalized system. And it's not exactly that we can be liberated from it. There's no place else to go. So what liberation might mean in the world we're in today and the world we'll probably be in the next decades, I think is harder to symbolize. It's not like leaving Egypt. What it is like, I don't know. But I think that the deep insights about the need to free ourselves from forces of domination is obviously valid. Where you would locate those forces is not so clear. And my hunch is that we have to locate them not only in the society around us and not only amongst the decision makers, but also within ourselves and within the values and the choices and the options and the preferences that even at a very modest level we make, because finally that's how we live our lives. And the question is then, how are we going to liberate ourselves in our family, in our community, in our parish, and in our neighborhood, and maybe not as much what seemed to be a total liberation from Egypt, as they said.
We're also about to mark the 30th anniversary of the assassination of Archbishop Romero. How much were the Jesuits, if you like, carrying on the mission that Archbishop Romero began?
I would say close to 100%. There was a very, very strong identification between him and them, and between them and him. I think it was mutual. And I think that they felt in the 10 years after his death, before the murder of the Jesuits, that they really were carrying on, and that to be working so hard for a negotiated settlement to this long-running civil war was certainly what he wanted and what he stood up for and what he died for. And so they carried that on, and in a certain sense, or not in a certain sense, they really gave their lives for what he wanted, that his country, his people, would come to a negotiated settlement and not try to resolve this conflict through force of arms and through bloodshed. So up to 1989 or 1990, I would say they were carrying on. And then in the 2 years after they were killed, as the negotiation did bring that result. And now I would say that the legacy of Romero and of the martyrs of the UCA is to represent a better alternative, to the present violence, poverty, and degradation, and also to other forces of domination, consumerism, cutthroat competition, market-driven decision-making in all spheres of life. Those are all things which are perhaps less visible than a civil war, but which require the same kind of vision, maybe even greater vision, and steadfastness and courage and generosity. And these are the values that all of these martyrs stood for, died for, and I have no doubt the people who continue to remember them are trying to live those same values. And this is the legacy. And it is celebrated at the UCA, at the university, every year on the 16th, the 15th and 16th of November. And I trust it will be celebrated in March next year as well.
My thanks there to Jesuit Father Michael Czerny.